All right, let's make sure you're in fellowship and continue on here dealing with the first two verses of this chapter with respect to the rising kingdom and its leader. He stood, again, as we pointed out, should be referred back to Satan as it is properly translated in the New American Standard. While there is a textual issue there, it is not I stood. He stood on the sand of the seashore, and I saw a beast coming up out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads, again, which are similar, as we see, to the beast previously in chapter 12, but different in that regard, the crowns were on the 7 heads. And that deals, of course, primarily with Satan's rule throughout history, whereas in this case, the crowns are on the 10 horns. And the 10 horns refer to the final 10 rulers, or the ones that will establish, as we will see, the composite beast, the entity known as the European Union currently. And on his heads were blasphemous names. And the beast I saw was like a leopard, and his feet were like those of a bear, and the mouth like the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power and his throne and great authority. So again, point 27 was the last one we looked at. While it is not specifically stated, the 10 horns are located on only one head, the last of the 7, with a crown of royalty on each horn slash power. 28, these 10 horns correspond with the 10 toes that Daniel saw in the great statue, and with the 10 horns that he observed on the nondescript beast. Both of these come right out, obviously, of the study of Daniel, where you had, in that regard, the first figure, a scene in the dream of Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 2, verse 41, deals with the feet and toes, but this is looking at the issue of the rulership in the world throughout time. And you had a head of gold, which was Babylon, we know, and then you had a chest and arms of silver, which was the Medo-Persia, and then you had the legs and thighs of bronze, which represented Greece, and then you had the feet and toes of iron, and then iron mixed with clay, which iron represented Rome, and the iron and the clay represent the 10 nations, the 10 toes, the 10 nations of the revived Roman Empire, as we call it, or the European Union. And also, this was a chronological flow throughout history. This giant statue represented first the fact that Babylon was in power, then it was passed to Medo-Persia, then to Greece, then to Rome, then to eventually the very end of human history down here is seen in the 10 toes. And those 10 toes have to be dealt with in terms of their eschatological existence, and that this is at the end of time, whereas this was back in, at that time, say 586 BC. It was slightly before that, but roughly during that time frame. And so you see that in verses 41 and 42, and then you saw the feet and toes partly of potter's clay and partly of iron. But it will have in it the toughness of iron. It will be a divided kingdom inasmuch as you saw the iron mixed with clay. And some of the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of pottery. And so some of the kingdom will be strong and some of it will be brittle. And verse 44 distinctly identifies us with the last days. Because in the days of those kings, in other words, at the time of their existence, God will set up a kingdom. The God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed. And so the 10 toes here correspond then in chapter 7, verse 7, to the 10 horns that we saw on the beast. And he doesn't mention the heads here in Daniel because he's primarily devoting his emphasis to the political power in the last days. And that's where his emphasis really is. And the final form in which this power is going to take. 29, they are associated with the coming empire, which will consist of a 10-nation confederacy that will give its allegiance to the Antichrist directly and to Satan indirectly. Satan, obviously, is the backbone of all of this, the unseen agent who is promoting the Antichrist himself. But Antichrist, as we saw, his coming is completely in accord with the activity of Satan. He is far willing to embrace Satan's viewpoint and to facilitate his plan. chapter 17, verse 13, these have one purpose, and they give their power and authority to the beast. And again, ultimately, whether they know it or not, if they're giving their authority to the beast and Satan's given his authority to the beast, they're giving their authority to Satan, whether they would acknowledge it or not. 30, the seven heads are also defined for us later in this book and point to seven great kingdoms of history and their respective leaders. Revelation 17, 9, and 10, here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. Mountains obviously represent the kingdom itself. And the fact that the woman, the mother-son cult, exercised great religious authority over these kingdoms. That's why she sits on them or is pictured as sitting on them, i.e. she exercises a lot of authority over them. And they are seven kings. So the seven heads, we're told specifically, can refer to the king or his kingdom, just depending upon what's in view. Five have fallen, which refers to the king, particularly. One is, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must remain a little while. And we'll see that the beast comes right out of all of that. So the seven heads are defined for us later in this book and point to seven great kingdoms of history and their respective leaders. A, the important aspect here is that the seven mountains or kingdoms and their kings are mostly historical in nature. And only one kingdom had not arisen at the time of writing. And so we have this pretty well divided for us at 100 A.D., where John is writing here, that five of these kingdoms are in the historical past. And since Antichrist was and is not at the time of writing, this kingdom here is Rome. The Antichrist has to come from one of these. And then, of course, you got this major gap of time up to circa 2000 A.D., and then you have the sixth king or the seventh kingdom, which the EU is already that kingdom. I mean, it's in its form. That what we're just waiting for is for the Antichrist to make his appearance and assume the leadership of that kingdom. They already have, as we know, they have a out of the ten, or there's more than that now, but ultimately the final form will be ten, that they elect a president every 6 months, and they're wanting to get away from this because one of the things they recognize is their president really doesn't have any power. He's a figurehead. He can't really do anything. And so they want to give him a lot more power and also make his term much longer. So that is in the process. And they also are in the process. They want a standing army. Now, they haven't done all this yet, but they are headed in this direction. So the important thing here is that only one kingdom had not arisen at the time of writing. B, while many have suggested that the seven mountains represent the seven hills of Rome, that is clearly without merit by virtue of what is said in verse 10. Because it says there are seven kings, and five have fallen and one is. That rules out Rome as being, quote, the fulfillment of those seven mountains. But again, they've taken the term mountain, made it literal when it's figurative here. And that obviously gets them into trouble. So 31, therefore one must recognize that the heads represent empires, which will follow one another chronologically. While the horns represent 10 eschatological kings, that word eschatological just means that which relates to the last days or the last things. They represent 10 eschatological kings that will rule at the same time. And that's the important thing to keep in your mind, is that the heads deal with a lot of history. I mean, history from the time of the earliest kingdom, which it turns out was Egypt, right on down to the revived Roman Empire. And these heads appeared at different times in history and exercised their sway as they did. And apparently each one of these heads is identified with one notable leader. When it says it's one, each head is a king. Now, we know that in Egypt, certainly during the dynasties of Egypt, there were lots of notable leaders. Well, which one would be in view becomes the question. And with Assyria, of course, if you can name any of the Assyrian leaders, a fortune in cash and prizes awaits you, but you probably can't. And Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, well, we know who his great leader was, but we have to kind of rule them out because Babylon's great leader became a believer. Nebuchadnezzar was certainly far and away the greatest leader of the Babylonian Empire. But he became a believer, and so he has to be ruled out. And then, of course, you got Medo-Persia. If you can name me any of their great leaders, again, you can be very rich. But most of you probably couldn't name one. Why? Because they're not well known. And then you had Greece, of course, and then Rome itself. And then the revived Roman Empire. And these are our seven heads. But these deal with historical kingdoms and their, of course, most notable leader. But then the ten horns represent ten guys that are in power all at the same time. All at the same time in history. And that's different. And so that is the purpose of, this is what's in view here in these verses in terms of the explanation of them. So, therefore, one must recognize that the heads represent empires, which follow one another chronologically, while the ten horns represent ten eschatological kings that will rule at the same time. 32, the composite beast is designed to portray Satan's agenda throughout history, i.e. the seven heads, along with his specific agenda in the final 7 years of Daniel's 70th week, the ten horns. And this he has had this agenda. This isn't anything new for him. This is exactly how he plans on doing it. He's planned on this for some time, as represented by these kingdoms and all of that. 33, the seven heads are empires that form the backbone of Satan's attempts against God's plan, must be identified in light of the explanation found in chapter 17, which associates these heads with the great whore. And so then you have to deal, and in a sense, really, you can't, I don't think, properly interpret Revelation 13 apart from Revelation 17, because they are very much intertwined. And, in fact, 17 gives us some of the explanation that we have to reach back and put into 13. Revelation 17:3, and he carried me away in the wilderness, in the spirit, into a wilderness. And I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast full of blasphemous names, having seven heads and ten horns. And we will see that that beast represents the kingdoms, that she has dominated the Antichrist system, that she has dominated throughout history and will continue to dominate even into Daniel's 70th week. 34, the great whore, which will receive a detailed treatment in that chapter, is the representation of the mother-son cult of religious Babylon, which originated as a political religious attack against the truth that reaches to antiquity. Now, this goes back to Genesis 4, which we saw when we studied that book, dealing with, or Genesis 11, rather, 11:4. And here we saw in the command God had instilled into the human race to, number one, go out and repopulate the world and not to stay in one isolated geographic region. Well, they violate that right away. Now, we recognize from what is said in verse 1, the whole earth used the same language and the same words. Any good linguist will tell you, you can do any study on this you want. They recognize that all languages descended from one mother tongue. They don't know what it is, what the original tongue was. But anybody can tell you that that has studied this, that this verse very much fits what we know of human history, that there was just simply one language that everybody used. So there were no barriers. That becomes the big issue. There were no barriers to cooperation and understanding and all of that because they didn't have any geopolitical barriers or any language barriers. So they came about as they journeyed east. They found a plain in the land of Shinar. This is in Babylon. Shinar is the land of Babylon, and settled there. Now, that wasn't what they were supposed to be doing, but that's what they did. In verse 4, they said, "Come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into heaven." And this is clearly directed as a human attempt to circumvent what had happened in the flood. Every one of these people were keenly aware of the flood. They brought the knowledge of the flood with them out of this whole dispersion that eventually came. And certainly, obviously, Noah and his sons passed all this information on, and their descendants got it. And they all had this knowledge of the flood, and they all recognized that God had done it. And there wasn't any way around it. And so they determined, well, we've got to be able to stop God in case he gets crazy once again and wants to flood us, even though they had a promise of no more flood. I mean, they'd been told that. So the idea of the tower whose top would reach into heaven is for protection. And let us make for ourselves another name. And that as a reference to another god. This is a religious system. It's political, and you see the concept of the city and the organization and all of that. But it's also a religious system. Lest we scatter abroad over the face of the whole earth. And, of course, the command was to scatter abroad. But they were violating this and substituting their human viewpoint and all of that. The political aspect is seen in the desire to build a city, while the religious aspect is seen in the fact that it is to reach into heaven. B, the religious aspect is further strengthened by the fact that they desired to make another name, which is properly understood to refer to another god. They didn't really want to worship the God of heaven. Obviously, they had some issues with him. I mean, it just flooded the whole earth and it killed everybody. And they recognized all this and knew it and recognized that, well, God, if he did it once, he could do it again, even though, again, they had the promise that he wouldn't. This is, again, their human viewpoint, satanic attempt to circumvent God's plan and do it their own way. And so that's what they did. 35, as we will observe in chapter 17 and 18, God will destroy both aspects of this abomination that has led mankind astray through the centuries. 36, therefore, we are correct in identifying these seven heads as seven kingdoms, six of which are historical and one is still future. 37, further, each of these seven heads has a history with the mother-son cult, and all have evidenced some hostility toward the woman of chapter 12. The fact that they're related to the mother-son cult gets back into the fact that the woman sits on the beast. Seven mountains on which the woman sits. So 38, the seven kingdoms are Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome, and the revived Roman Empire, the modern confederacy that is currently known as the EU. 39, the first five heads were in the historic past as at the time John writes this book. Rome was in power at that time, and the other king was yet to be manifested in human history. Still has not been. We haven't seen him yet. He has not shown up. That won't happen until after the rapture. So pre-rapture attempts to identify a person living on the planet as the Antichrist are very misguided. You can't do it. And I've heard all these suggestions over the years. It was Hitler. It was Kissinger. It was Kennedy. It was Reagan. Whoever else they think it's going to be. Well, guess what? They're wrong. They're all wrong. It's not any of them. And so for them to be even looking around is a waste of time. 40, John now notes that the seven heads each have blasphemous names, which are described only by this general term. 41, there is a textual question here that is pretty evenly divided as to whether this should be a singular name or a plural names. Well, A, the difference would be a singular blasphemous name was written on all seven heads, or multiple blasphemies were indicated. And B, while there is little difference, the emphasis is on the blasphemy, the quality of the words, and not the quantity. The plural is clearly used in Revelation 17:3, as we pointed out in the exegesis of this, that the beast was full of blasphemous names. And so the reading here may be influenced by that, having a name of blasphemy or blasphemous names, plural, with the influence from 17:3. 42, no small number of interpreters see this beast as a reference to Imperial Rome only, and their blasphemous names refer only to the title of Theos, which is God, which was assumed by many of them. And 43, however, we are dealing with seven distinct kingdoms, and those that head each kingdom, so this passage is to be applied to them and their blasphemy. So the blasphemy is through all these kingdoms. It's not just through the one, not just through Rome. And in A, while this would include Rome, it is not to be limited to the Roman emperors only. 44, the blasphemous names focus on the arrogance that appropriates the prerogatives of God, rejects his rule, and acts in complete defiance of him. And that's really what this is all about. This is all about man at its zenith, we might say, mankind, at its zenith doing their doctrines of Luciferian humanism and taking them to the ultimate extreme, in which man is exalted to the top, God is, in effect, deposed, if he's even alive at all, would be kind of their thought, and that Lucifer has gotten a bad rap, and that he is here to enlighten us and take us to the realm of Eden and paradise. And that's what the world thinks. That's where they think they're headed. So again, this is the nature of these people. This is what they're headed for. This is how God sees it. Now, the world's not going to see it that way. They're going to see it as just the opposite. Antichrist is going to be the great Savior. He's going to be the Messiah. He's going to be a man of peace. There's probably going to be plenty of prosperity under his reign and all of that. And well, guess what? This isn't how God sees it. This is, again, arrogance to its ultimate. 45, in this case, it refers to the blasphemous character of the Gentile powers, which have supported the mother-son cult throughout history, which is a complete affront to the true God. The mother-son cult, as we will get into, reaches back again to antiquity, really to the Tower of Babel, and has always existed, and has always been a complete system of falsehood and things that God hates, as we'll see. That's one of the... He views the whole system as that of a whore, of a prostitute. And that we'll deal with again at length in chapter 17. 46, the body of this unusual beast is now described as being comprised of three distinct animals, having the overall appearance of a leopard, but with the feet of a bear and the mouth of a lion. 47, again, when symbols are used to describe something, the interpreter must look first to the nature of the symbol itself and ask why it would be employed. Well, 48, we have seen the symbols of the leopard, bear, and lion before in Daniel 7. But in that case, each was used to portray a specific national entity. The leopard, as we saw there, with four heads and the four wings on its back, represented the political alliance between probably China and three other nations who are going to be ideologically similar and will form a confederacy that comes out of the east that is capable of massing a 200 million man army. And as we pointed out when we did the study of that, that the symbol of the leopard very well fits that character. It is, first and number one, foremost, an oriental beast. It primarily resides in the east. And beyond all that, of course, the leopard is not concerned with blocking when you fight. The leopard is encouraged with attacking only. Just wave after wave of relentless assault. And that very much fits the character of what you're going to have when you throw a 200 million man army into the fray. You're not going to worry about, hey, we lost 100,000 men today. Big deal. You know, you get three Americans killed in Iraq and it's a tragedy. They'll lose 100,000, 200,000, 500,000. Who cares? Oh, we've lost 500,000. So we're down to 199,500,000 now? Well, guess what? You have to slaughter a lot of people to make a dent in that army. You lose a million of them, and you've only lost 1/200th of your forces. You know, so they're obviously not too worried. I mean, you can lose 5% of your army and do okay. That's not really a problem. So that's the nature of the leopard, and that's why it was picked to portray these people. The bear, obviously, as we know, represents Russia, the great hibernating beast that's going to come awake and create the massive destruction. It's going to arise, as we saw there, and devour much flesh. And then the lion represented Great Britain, which is a normal feature on their escutcheon you can check out. The reality is, of course, Britain has a history in their insignias and all of that with the Davidic covenant. And so... as we saw, they're going to have a bit of a spiritual turnaround after the destruction of the U.S. 49, the lion is certainly is fitting in that it is the king of the beasts. And we will see that this king and his kingdom appear to have no serious rivals. Revelation 13:4, and they worship the dragon because he gave his authority to the beast. And they worship the beast, saying, who is like the beast? And who is able to wage war with him? And the reality is, of course, that this conquering hero, as we will see, is viewed as invincible. And part of that invincibility appears to be the fact that he's going to sustain an apparently deadly wound and be recovered from it, as we will deal with in verse 3. One, male lions recognize the value of coalitions for acquiring and defending territory, having an unconditional affection for their partners. They will really cooperate, strangely enough. And this gets into the whole concept of the alliance and the whole deal, the figure of the Confederacy. And in B, males will always cooperate with each other in defending their territory from any intruder, even when they are outnumbered. 50, the second animal is the bear, which may appear very bulky and slow, weighing as much as 825 pounds. However, they have strong legs, are very quick, and attain speeds of 35 miles an hour for a short distance. A, we know that the bear is the symbol for the Soviet Union, which has demonstrated a complete lack of compassion and hostility in its annihilation of the U.S. One of the things, when you get into the passages on the destruction of the U.S., is it's spoken of in terms of its complete and absolute disregard for anything that we might consider moral laws of warfare, that they will dash the children to pieces. They don't care. Having the figure of grabbing the children up by the feet, and you just bash them against the wall, and that kills them. And obviously the Soviets are not going to worry about, in terms of their warfare, not going to worry about any of that type of thing. It doesn't matter to them if they're civilians. It's not going to matter. And so it's going to be very, very brutal. And the children are going to fare no better than the adults do. And so obviously that's a very fitting figure for Antichrist too. He, as it turns out, he's going to be ruthlessly brutal, just like the bear. And these animals are certainly used of his kingdom for good reason. Just as the lion, and that day he will be the king of the beasts. And he will be absolutely brutal and ruthless of his suppression of anybody who rejects him and anybody who rejects his system. And B, even so, Antichrist and his kingdom will demonstrate a complete lack of compassion in their policies and will operate under the Luciferian humanistic premise that might makes right. 51, the third animal mentioned is the leopard, which very well fits the character of Antichrist as an extremely swift and speedy predator. A, there can be little doubt that Antichrist will move quickly and decisively against those that he considers to be a threat. There in Daniel 7:8, you saw he plucks out those three horns by the roots, which indicates that their kingdom will not survive, that they will be assimilated by him. Now, why they oppose him, we're not told. But it gets in probably to the iron and the clay issue. That part of the iron is the strength, the military, ruthless might of the kingdom, and the clay represents the weaker aspects of it. That some of these people are not as big on military. Some of them are way more pacifist. Say France has always been historically more pacifist than, say, Germany has. That some of the nations are far more aggressive and some are far more passive. And so the passive ones may not like the new policies. They may not like the fact that Antichrist is ruthlessly crushing anybody that gets in his way. For whatever reason, they decide to withstand him, which doesn't work out to their benefit, of course. He will completely destroy him. And then B, further, the character of the leopard is being somewhat inscrutable, being able to remain motionless for long periods of time as it stalks its prey, which is suddenly overpowered and destroyed. Again, Daniel 7:8. The Antichrist will do what he, you know, and this is a whole part of his inscrutability. I mean, he's literally taking orders from Satan, but coming across as a Messiah. And so he's obviously a very much a duplicitous person and very much got these people snowed in terms of his true motivations and in terms of his true loyalties and allegiance and all of that. And so he perfectly fits the bill for what the world deserves, because they desire deception rather than the truth. They desire darkness rather than light, so they're going to get it. And they're going to get it in spades. The 52, the composite nature of this beast is designed to demonstrate that this kingdom and its leader will possess the cunning, power, speed, and autocratic force to do whatever it wills. 53, the fact that this and other kingdoms are characterized by beasts is to underscore that these kingdoms are cruel and dominated by the lower nature of man. They are not honorable, and particularly in their dealings with Israel, that's another whole reason why you have this nature of the wild beast. They are viewed as a lower form of creation, even though they're, you know, animate and conscious and all that. They're certainly not viewed as being on a par with man. As we saw there, like, say, for instance, the lion is raised up on its hind feet and given the mind of a man. Clearly, that's viewed as a superior situation. And so these beasts are picked specifically. Why wild animal? Why a beast? and is to portray their nature. 54, as one might expect, such qualities are desirable from the satanic point of view. And what follows in verse 2 should hardly be considered surprising. 55, following his ejection from heaven, Satan must reside on planet Earth and obviously sets up his throne for that purpose. Now, at various times in history, back in Revelation 2:13, we saw, in terms of the church at Pergamum, I know where you dwell, where Satan's throne is. And so obviously there's a specific spot he chooses for whatever reason during history, and he's always worked through political powers. That's part of what Satan's deal is. God works through doctrine. He works through politics. What does that tell us? Well, politicians pretty much don't have much doctrine on the ball to speak of. I read in the paper today they're deciding now Bush has taken a stand. He's against gay marriage. Well, the Democrats are like, well, it's going to be hard for us to take a stand. It's an election year. What do you mean? Well, what I mean is that we can't really say what we think because we've got to have the votes from these fags. And we're not going to win if we take a stance that they don't like. And so the point is, obviously now, one of the issues is, of course, Bush wants a constitutional amendment to define what marriage is. We need that? I thought we knew what marriage was. Well, apparently we don't. But this is, again, a part of the infiltration of evil, the domination of the negative volition of society. And the fact is that the vast majority of our culture is for this stuff. They're not against it. You don't hear outrage. You don't hear people standing up against this. And they are also, actually now, they're wanting to make it a federal hate crime if you speak against anybody who's a queer. And now you will be under a federal indictment for speaking the truth that God's against all this. And that's where we're headed. Because once in the second you start trying to make rights for people that don't have rights, then you've got big problems. And so the argument is, well, they're human beings, they have rights. No, they're not. And I've heard that argument, too, about, you know, one of the deals on the paper again today was the deal about they're trying to clean up the voter rolls because they got to get all these felons off the voter rolls because you lose your rights when you become a felon. That's just the way it is. It's always been the way it is. And society has always endorsed that you lose certain rights when you do certain things. But now, of course, society is much more liberal, and, you know, this is all viewed as being an open-minded person and, you know, positive in terms of your outlook on life, and a good global citizen embraces anybody and everybody, and whatever they want to do is fine. And, you know, no, some of it's flat evil, and some of it's flat wrong. And guess what? The society is not going to endorse that. So they pass it, you know, obviously if you voted here or didn't vote here, you know, they pass laws here. We've got to have a law mandating that these homosexual unions have rights. No, we don't. We don't have to have a law for that. They don't have rights. They're not a marriage. They're not a family. They can't procreate. By any normal definition of the family, they can't do anything. They can live together. Well, big deal. I can get a dog and live with a dog. So what? Doesn't make it a marriage. So anyway, that's where it's headed, and the politicians aren't going to do anything about it other than talk about it. But they won't make any moral stands that'll really make any difference because they fear for the, you know, you can't really tick people off in Florida because everybody knows this is going to be a key state. So we've got to make nice with all these people. So again, the satanic point of view, this guy embraces all this and all of that. And following his ejection from heaven there, Satan sets up his throne for at some point. 56, as we know, God has chosen to work through individual believers and the corporate church. Even so, Satan chooses to work through evil men and political powers to accomplish his plans. Politics are one of his trump cards. And the fact is, the politicians really don't worry about too much of anything other than how to stay in power. And that's really all politicians generally have ever done. And that is the goal is to stay in power. And that we saw that very much so when we were looking in John there, when Caiaphas and the leadership of Israel, what was their big fear? Their big fear was that the people would turn on them and they'd lose power. And they couldn't have that. And that's what politicians are all about, get in power and stay in power. And then, you know, whatever you can do and all of that. Well, again, that doesn't really accomplish anything for the constituents. That's because they're really not looking out for them. They're really looking out for their own best interests. No matter all the great speeches and wonderful talk and all that aside, bottom line is here's what they do. And it's always been that way. 57, since he is a finite creature and can only be at one place in the space-time continuum, his limitations now cause him to seek that which is most compatible with his own nature, which he effectively finds in Antichrist. 58, this verse demonstrates that we are to understand that the kingdom and the king are both in view in our passage, as the language now shifts to that of a single individual rather than an entire kingdom. A, there is historical precedence for this, as modern man have identified an entire nation with a single individual, as in the case of Hitler, Stalin, and Mao, for instance. I mean, I don't have to say the name of their kingdom because you know what nation they ruled. Every one of them. You know them just by name. And B, a quote from Newsmax.com likewise views an individual as the nation. The state at the moment is Vladimir Putin, a man the newspaper says has few apparent ideological convictions. Well, that's a good guy to have in charge in the Soviet Union then if you don't have many ideological convictions. Because he won't have too much of a problem doing anything then. So 59, Satan now provides for the Antichrist his three most essential possessions and attributes. And one of the things when you get into this here is that the power, the throne, and the great authority are Satan's himself. It is an individual's power, throne, and great authority. And what he focuses on here is giving this individual his power, his throne, and his great authority. And it's in the satanic chain of command is going to run like this. We have a chain of command in the royal chain of command. Then you have the Antichrist, then the false prophet, and he'll actually even delegate authority down here to some of the people to do things he wants them to do. And there will be a spiritual chain of command, just like there is in the divine viewpoint realm. Only this will all be satanic, and the chain of command is going to run just like that. So Satan now provides for Antichrist his three most essential possessions and attributes, which he offered Jesus Christ at the first advent. Matthew 4, 1 and following. There the as Jesus was led up to the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And after he had fasted 40 days and 40 nights, he then became hungry. And the tempter said to him, if you are the Son of God, command that these stones become bread. And so he tells him he doesn't live by bread alone. He took him up to the holy city and had him stand on the pinnacle of the temple. Said, if you're the Son of God, throw yourself down. For it is written. And then he says, no, on the other hand, you shall not tempt the Lord your God to a test. And the devil took him up to a very high kingdom and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. And said, all these things I will give you. He's giving it to a single, offering all this to a single individual. If you will fall down and worship me. Well, see, the Antichrist has no problem with this. He doesn't mind falling down and worshiping Satan. That's not a problem for him. And so he gets here, one of the things, the irony is, because he is very much an Antichrist, he gets what Jesus rejected, which was the worship of Satan and all the attendant temporal blessing that would go with that. But that temporal blessing is just exactly that, temporary. It doesn't last long. And he was seeking eternal glory, not temporal glory. And so he shot for the bigger picture. So 60, the first thing Satan provides for the beast is his supernatural power, his ability to operate apart from normal physical constraints and all that that entails. Now that becomes an issue is how much he obviously is going to be able to do things in a supernatural way. We're told that in 2 Thessalonians there, chapter 2, that whose coming is in accord with the activity of Satan, with every miracle and false signs and false wonders. So he's going to be able to do some pretty phenomenal stuff. And it's not going to be, it's not going to be like David Copperfield. You know, people say, oh, he made the Statue of Liberty disappear. Well, not really. It's still there, I think. That's an illusion. He's not going to be doing illusions. you're not going to be able to look at him and say, well, that's just, you know, that's a trick. We know how he did it. No. They won't be able to explain it away. That becomes the whole focal point of all of this, is that in his claims to be God, he has to manifest supernatural abilities. And he does, and he will. But these abilities don't come from God. They come from Satan. So again, if he's not operating under the normal physical constraints, how much information will he have? He could have a ton of information. Well, 61, much like Jesus Christ, one man will now have the spiritual power and understanding of a creature that has a vast amount of knowledge, ability, and experience, and the resources of a spiritual army of demons at his command. I would assume that if he's got authority, Satan's authority, he can command the demons just as well. Satan commands them, certainly, at this point anyway. And so what all will be involved in that? How will he manifest these supernatural characteristics? It'll be in such a way that, one, people won't be able to argue with it. They're not going to be able to look the other way and say, oh, well, that was just a trick. No, it's not just a trick. 62, the second specific item he provides for Antichrist is his throne, which refers to his sovereign position of rulership over the world. 63, there is little doubt that Satan is the prince of this world, ruling men in his kingdom through the principle of darkness, lies, deception, and sheer power, as seen in Luke there, which is also, I believe, a parallel with the temptation there of Matthew 4. I think Luke 4 is parallel to that. Verses 5 and 6. Yeah, he showed him all the kingdoms of the world in a moment of time. Now, that's got to be pretty impressive to be able to have that kind of... Well, how did he do that? I mean, obviously, time is not a factor in this thing. Time, in a sense, we might say, stopped there as he showed him all of this glory. And the devil said to him, I will give you all this domain and its glory, for it has been handed over to me, and I give it to whomever I wish. And Jesus didn't argue with him. He didn't say, oh, no, the world's not yours. It was forfeited, as we saw, by Adam at the fall, the authority over factor over it. And Satan willingly stepped in, became the squatter, took over, he obeyed Satan in his viewpoint, and so guess what? Satan becomes his new master. And all that Adam had, he ended up giving up to Satan. In 2 Corinthians 4:4, also, documents that this world is his. In whose case, the God of this world. Now, we might even translate this, the God who owns this world. Because that's really what's in view there, is his ownership has blinded the minds of the unbelieving, that they might not see the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. 64, for some reason, he must be willing to abdicate or at least share the rulership of the world with this human being, who must certainly advance whatever plan Satan has. We've got to suspect that he's not just going to do this arbitrarily or without some good reasons, that Antichrist is certainly busily engaged, as it says, and his coming is in accord with the activity of Satan, that Satan has this activity, whatever it is he does. He's got all these activities he performs. Well, Antichrist, Satan observes him and says, hey, this guy's just, I like him. He and I think a lot alike. And so the Antichrist is he readily hands him over his power. And Satan's never done this that we know of to anybody. I mean, there's no biblical account that Satan ever turned over his power and his throne and his authority to anybody else. He's only going to do it in this one occasion in history. So 65, the reason that Satan may be willing to do this is the renown that Alexander brings to this position. I'm still of the opinion that the best explanation for Antichrist is that it is Alexander the Great. And if that's the case, what will the world think? An actual human from the past, revered by many, not associated with the devil. And that's not a public relations plus for most people. I mean, if you walk up and you say, hey, by the way, I represent the devil, would you worship me and follow me? Most people, normal people, even unbelievers would say, get away from me. They're not. That obviously is not going to be the tack that he takes. He's obviously going to play up all these other things that, hey, this guy wasn't evil. this guy was just a great conqueror and a great military guy, and he died before his time. And so, obviously, again, whatever, who, assuming it's not Alexander, whatever unbeliever comes up out of the abyss and works here with Satan is going to bring a lot of pluses to the table, apparently. That people are going to, they're not going to look at him and go, ooh. They're going to look at him and go, wow. And it's going to be, you know, obviously, they're going to be infatuated with him. That comes across loud and clear a little later. So 66, he clearly has a talent for uniting and conquering matched by none in history, and is the most appropriate for the political arena in which he is to operate. In fact, any cursory study of Alexander and any of these things, you go do any research on him and you'll find out that everybody knows that there isn't a military genius that's ever lived that was any greater than Alexander. And there wasn't a political genius that ever lived. He had a real knack for uniting people. And in fact, the Greek city-states were in somewhat disarray before he decided to get them together. And the Medo-Persians were, at that point, well into Asia Minor, and were beginning to wanted to make inroads across the Aegean there into Greece itself. And about this time in history, Alexander rises up and unites the city-states and goes out and defeats these people. He brought in also new military strategies that had never been seen before, and different ways of going about things, and he was clearly a genius. There's just no question. He defeated many people. He was outnumbered numerous times, and ended up winning battles that he shouldn't have ever won. I mean, not from a physical point of view. You look at it and say, well, you're outnumbered 100,000 to 50,000, and you win? How do you do that? Well, he understood the principles of warfare and brought a lot of things to it. And he was very good at uniting people. He tended to be, of course, he was a one-worlder. And he tended to unite. This was one of the problems that got him into trouble with some of his men, was because he was such a politician, he tended to encourage intermarriage amongst the peoples that he had conquered, particularly the Greeks with the Medo-Persians, in order to consolidate the power of the kingdom. That if these people were in families, they were going to tend to cooperate a lot more, and they would be a lot easier to control. So, again, he has a talent. There isn't anybody I can think of that's matched by Alexander. And again, if it's not Alexander, it's got to be somebody better. If it's not him, it's got to be somebody that Satan thinks is even more worthy. So 67, the final phrase, great authority, refers to the ability to rule effectively. The freedom to make spiritual and physical decisions that will allow him to dominate the world scene. Now, we certainly know one of the interesting things is here that, see, these policies that come down have to come from somewhere. And so you look at, we understand that, say, the EU is predominantly located in Europe, and that's what the Europeans want. But these policies that he's going to make are going to extend beyond that. This deal that the false prophet does that you can't buy or sell. How would you enforce that, say, in the middle of Africa? And who would care? And the reality is, from what I can tell studying this, that it's going to be like a trickle-down deal. That he will say, all right, you're doing $1 billion worth of business in Europe. You got to take the mark. You got to have this mark or you can't participate anymore. Well, you think businessmen are going to walk away from $1 billion a year? No, not at all. And then the rule will come, well, then now your suppliers have to have it. And I think he will just simply start at the top and let it work its way down naturally. And then, of course, your average person in Europe is going to be all too willing to do this anyway. It'll be easy to deal with the populace there because they tend to be very much in favor of a united Europe. A whole bunch of them do anyway, not all of them, but a lot of them do. So again, this is where it's headed. And 69 rather, therefore the Antichrist will have the satanic weapons at his disposal, possessing the authority to set and maintain policy and the power to make certain that compliance is forthcoming. In 70, as Larkin has stated, he will have the marvelous gift of personality, his versatile attainment, superhuman wisdom, great administrative and executive ability, along with his powers as a consummate flatterer, a brilliant diplomatist, and a superb strategist. He will have the marvelous gift of attracting unregenerate man as the most conspicuous and prominent of men on the planet. And there will be, of course, no one to rival him. And that's what they ask. Who is able to wage war with him? And he's viewed clearly as the dominant military man of his day. The people cannot defeat him. And in fact, as we will see, the beast that comes out of the abyss here, as we had this mentioned back in chapter 11, with the two witnesses, when they have finished their testimony, the beast that comes up out of the abyss will make war with them and will overcome them. And this is only going to lend to his mystique, that he's defeated the two undefeatable prophets and whoever else he's defeated by that time, which there's probably going to be others. All right, well, our time is up, so we will stop there and resume here on Wednesday. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying these things. May God the Holy Spirit enlighten us in Christ's name. Amen.